WQHT, Hot 97 in New York, along with a host of other stations across the country, has announced a deal with YMF Media to purchase two New York radio stations for $131 million in cash. The acquisition of the two stations, urban adult contemporary station WBLS 107.5 FM and WLIB 1990 AM in the city's first station targeted at African-American listeners, will double Emmis's annual station operating income, the company said. The company announces not just that they are buying WBLS, but bringing in somebody to run both WBLS and Hot 97 together. Our general manager, Alex, is out. This guy who's going to run the place, Dion Levingston, comes from WBLS. That was his baby. His shining star. Now Hot 97 would become the stepchild. People were getting fired left and right. Good people who had worked for Hot for a really long time. And it was merging into an unfamiliar, strange step family. When WBLS came in, we were still shooting the TV show. So we're in the hallway shooting this buffoonery, and these older BLS people are walking around like, what the fuck are they doing? Dion, the general manager, did not like the show, you could tell. Very weird energy. We're shooting this show that we all hate, that Alex made us do. Alex doesn't even work here anymore. Ebro's the fucking star of the show. We don't have a program director in place. It's a circus. I didn't even recognize the place anymore. When the show aired that spring, I didn't tune in. I couldn't do it. My weird ability to ignore something as if it doesn't even exist kicked in. And I was just so happy it was over. It was canceled after the first season. Everything was unraveling. And the whispers grew into shouts. What am I holding on to? I don't feel the same way about this place. I mean, I love being on the radio. And I love my friends here. But I don't love how this ship is being run anymore. Either I'm going to sit on this sinking ship, or I am going to get off the fucking boat. At that point, I still didn't know what that meant. But I knew it was time for me to move on. It was coming. It was getting close. My contract was up already. With all the changes in management, nobody seemed to notice or care. This new general manager barely had a conversation with me. Maybe once. Maybe he had too much on his plate. So anything could happen to the station at this point. And it wasn't just us. This move was going to do the same demolition to the legendary Kiss FM and put some of the most iconic names in radio off the air. The same could easily happen to Hot. Almost everybody at the station was feeling uncomfortable, uneasy, hating the way shit was going down. I was walking into the studio one day and Enough approached me in the hallway outside. Hey, you good? Yeah, I said. I know shit is crazy, Enough said. Ange, I know you're frustrated. Yeah. Just let me know when it's time, he said. Give me a heads up. I looked at him and I said, I'm giving you a heads up. You are? Mm-hmm. Like right now? And I just nodded my head like, right now. I went back into the studio and I still didn't know what I would do or when I would do it. But the feeling inside had gone from foggy to clear. This chapter of my life was ending. What am I going to do? What's my next move? Aronde knew everything I'd been going through and had witnessed my building frustration. He came home one night and told me that Chris Green, a record rep who also happens to be Tiffany's boyfriend, had said that Power 105.1 had been asking what was up with my contract. They've been asking that question for years, I told Aronde. His point was, as bad as things were, you should meet with them. What could it hurt? As much as working for Power was not an option for me, I couldn't even fathom the thought. I was intrigued by Clear Channel, the parent company. They were doing some innovative things in the industry with their iHeart app and music festival. A lot of people were paying attention. Maybe Aronde was right. What could a conversation hurt? The first thing I did was call Pecas. Over the years, Pecas had come to me a few times about Clear Channel wanting to work with me. I'm not talking to them. I had insisted in the past. Fuck them. I had always been fiercely loyal to Hot 97. Could I really work there? I wasn't sure, but I had to know my options. If I talk to Doc, do you think he could keep it confidential? I asked Pecos. Doc was the head program director for all the urban stations at Clear Channel, which is now iHeart. Yeah, Peck said, sounding slightly surprised yet totally unfazed. Pecos, promising me we would keep it confidential, set up a meeting for me with Doc. He's at the London Hotel, he said. He's going to meet you by the bar. The London? The London Hotel is a popular spot. It's not a discreet place. But I was so removed at this point, I really didn't even care. And it was at 11 a.m. in the morning, so fuck it, I just went. Sitting down with Doc was so weird for me because of all the history. All of the years that they had been the enemy. Now I'm actually sitting here, having tea with him. I didn't even want to get a meal. I wasn't even committing to breaking bread. I have a mint tea. Well, it's really nice to meet you, Doc said. First, I just want to say how much I respect you and everything that you've done. I think you're amazing. He went on to talk about what he knew of my career. I'd heard that he was a really nice guy. We had a great conversation. So where are you in your career right now? Doc asked. You know, I'm at a point where I want to know what my options are for my future. Not just for right now, but for 5 years from now, I said. I want to have an understanding of what the landscape looks like in radio, and I thought you would be a good place to start. Well, is your contract up? Yep. Really? His eyeballs opened wide. You know, it's so funny, he said. I've been with the company for so many years, and every year we get these numbers about what radio personalities resonate in the market. Your name is always at the top of that list. So every year it comes up, the question is, what do we have to do to get her? Every year we have the same conversation. We can't get her. She's too loyal. She's never going to come here. That's always the conversation. But you know what's so crazy is it got to the point some years ago that nobody even asked anymore, he goes. But this year we had somebody new to the company that hadn't had the conversation yet. So we get the numbers back just like always. You're at the top of the perceptual for the market. And the person says, well, can we get her? Well, what do we got to do to get her? Doc had said, it's never going to happen. We've tried. She won't even talk to us. 2 days later, Pecos called him. Doc couldn't believe it. She wants to talk? It was so funny and flattering. So what would you want to do? What would your ideal situation be? Honestly, I don't know. I would want to be on in more cities than one. I want growth. I don't want to go somewhere and have the same exact thing. I want more. He understood that. And to be honest, I don't even think I had wrapped my brain around the fact that I would have to be on Power 105.1. I was really looking at them as a big company. Maybe I could be on in LA, in Miami, in Philly. At that point, I was still not mentally prepared to commit to the idea that I would go to the competition. Well, you know, we'd want to have you on in New York, he said, just as I gulped my mint tea. Oh, God. Doc promised to poke around and offered to get back to me. Sure, whatever, I said, telling myself to stay open yet feeling kind of crazy. Holy shit, I just met with Clear Channel. Oh, my God. Just even having tea with the man felt like such a big deal. I'm sneaking out of the London hoping nobody sees me. The next step was a meeting Doc wanted me to have with Thea, the vice president of programming for all the New York stations, Z100, Power, KTU. She's the program director of Power, and she oversees all the other ones, so she's the New York person. I knew meeting Thea was going to include talking about me being on Power. I knew what that conversation was. So now, Thea and I are meeting at the Dream Hotel, even more fucking popular than the London. I'm going to meet them in their suite. At least we're not going to be in the main bar. So I pulled up to the hotel and Thea sneaks out of the elevator and we're walking really quietly and quickly to the elevator. We ordered sushi and wine up to the room for dinner. I love sushi and wine. And the fact that Thea wanted to order sushi and wine gave me some sense of comfort. She's not the evil enemy. She's somebody in radio who likes wine and sushi just like me. I know that sounds corny and crazy, but it took away the whole facade of her being this big bad enemy person. both of us were a little guarded. A lot of radio personalities, they'll talk to the competition in order to get their money up and then go back to their station and go, well, Clear Channel said they're going to give me XYZ. What are you going to do? So maybe she was skeptical. Why now? She asked. Why would you meet with us now? Honestly, Thea, I don't even know what I want to do or what my next step is. And I told her the truth, the same thing I told Doc. I'm just curious to know what my options are. I'm evaluating my career and what I want the next few years to look like. And honestly, the station has changed a lot. I didn't want to give her too much. I didn't want her to think I was unhappy and ready to go right now. But I wanted to be honest. After a little bit of wine and some sushi, we got a little more comfortable. But we still didn't say that much. Because, you know, at this point, we're still competition, sitting there together eating. From there, Thea and I started talking, texting, emailing. I would love to make this work somehow, she said. Let's start thinking about what it would take to do that. Thea and I are a lot alike in terms of we say what we mean and we mean what we say. We're not gossipy people. It was a very direct conversation from the beginning, and we agreed about not letting word get out to the public or anyone for that matter. The conversation is safe here. It needed to be. After a few very honest talks, they sent me an offer that was good. Really good. And it wasn't just about the money. I was now going to have a more national profile, with a show airing in multiple cities. All this time, I hadn't even thought about what my vision for growth even looked like. Suddenly, I realized that this was exactly what I needed. To take what I did to something bigger than being at one station. To a company where even further growth was possible. Clearly, as in all breakups, I had to face the truth that Hot was no longer the place I had fallen in love with. It was a really easy decision. That part was easy. But then I'd stop myself and panic. What about Enough? And Flex? Miss Info and Mr. C? Am I not going to see these people anymore? How does this work? How is this going to be perceived? First came the logical decision that I had made clearly with no outside thoughts. Then came the understanding of all the noise that would come with it. Do I not leave and take this great opportunity because I want to work with my friends forever? I talked it over with Aronde, who was wildly supportive throughout the whole process. He was able to look at everything from a more practical perspective because he didn't have the emotional connection to Hot that I did. All he cared about was what was in my best interest. These were some of the benefits of dating a talent manager, and I took full advantage. He helped me see that my fears were unfounded. The people who are my friends, they're still going to be my friends. Sure, it's fun to work with your friends, but when you have a family and you want to grow and evolve, then sometimes that means change. Yet, even with Aronde's counsel, I had to sit with all of this on my own. That's me. Again, it's how I problem solve. I have to throw out all the other opinions and get internal and figure it out for myself. In that space, it became clear. I know that ultimately I have to deal with myself, by myself. I'm going to have to go in and resign. I'm going to have to sit in that chair a last time. I'm going to have to go on that radio and tell everybody that I'm doing this. So ultimately, I have to be okay with all parts of that. So I got really quiet and figured it out. Other than Aronde, I didn't even tell my lawyer until Thea and I had already come to a bunch of agreements. As I was closing in toward the end of the deal, I was at Don Coqui in City Island having dinner with Becas and my longtime friends Fat Joe and his wife Lorena. The three of them were there at dinner with me as I was at the table texting with Thea, negotiating little details, the last points. She had me down for 3 weeks of vacation. I need 4 weeks of vacation. Fine, 4 weeks. Oh my God, I feel like we're done. It feels like we are. Right there at Don Coqui, it hits me. Holy shit. I think it's done, I tell Pecas privately. Mind you, I had kept him out of the loop after he set up the first meeting with Doc. I think I have a deal. Pecas was already a few drinks in, and I'm not sure he believed me or fully understood what I was trying to tell him. I didn't mention another word to anyone and spent the rest of the night toasting to my big secret. The next day, the lawyers start going over the details. I'm in contract mode, but I'm still going to work every day at HOT. I'm not telling anybody anything. We're promoting Summer Jam. I'm there. I'm still in it. But I know that I'm not going to be for long. Being at Summer Jam that last time was the weirdest and most surreal thing ever. Standing on the stage, I took a picture of the audience. The crowd is so big. I marveled. I definitely had a moment there. My breath. It was like a gasp. Wow. This will be the last time I'm here. I felt the weight of it. For the past 18 fucking years, this was who I was. It was the end of an era. Staring out into the crowd, I wanted to be fully in the moment. I wanted to make sure to not miss it. Sometimes I ignore shit and keep it pushing just to get to the next step, but I wanted to feel this. Be there. Appreciate it. And I didn't feel any sadness about it. That's how I knew I was so ready. There was nothing about this that I wasn't ready to walk away from. Yet I didn't feel a disconnect from the audience in any way. I didn't feel like I wasn't going to see them again. They were just going to see me somewhere else. Nobody knew. So that whole day was just me, deep in my own head, in my own world. When the day was over, I went home feeling full, complete, and ready for whatever was next to come. I had my assistant TJ start backing up all my files at the station. I had multiple lockers full of cassettes, DATs, and CDs of interviews from the 90s and all my old archives. He was putting them on hard drives and taking boxes of tapes and CDs to my car, two at a time. I don't think he realized why he was doing it, but TJ was a soldier and he was loyal. So even if he did suspect, he would never question or say anything. I didn't know how the station was going to take it when I left. Sometimes what happens in radio is that you leave to go to the competition and they take your key card, erase all your shit. You don't get anything and your past is your past. Anxiety starts flooding my mind, thinking about all the things that could happen. Is Flex going to be mad at me? How's Enough going to take it? Can I at some point bring Enough with me? Would he even want to come? In your contract, you're not allowed to take anybody with you for at least 6 months. It's called poaching. I was worried about what was going to happen to some of them. In preparing myself for these conversations, I got the tragic news that Flex had lost his mother. This was awful. Flex was very close with his mom, and he was taking it really hard. It broke my heart to watch him go through that. At the funeral, I stood in the back of the room looking at him, hurting for him, and just praying for him to be okay. I went over to offer my condolences and saw him sitting in the chair in so much pain. I bent down to kiss him on his forehead. Even though I dreaded having to have the conversation with him about going to Power, it needed to happen soon. Still, he had just lost his mom. I don't want to tell him this. Thea and I had come up with a strategic plan. When are we going to do this? Thea had to make some changes in her lineup and fire her midday girl, so she had to be able to tell her staff. I had to be able to resign and tell my staff. And neither one of us wanted to do it and let the other side find out in a bad way. We had to do it at the same time. I was honest with Thea with one exception. Listen, I do have to tell Flex beforehand, I said. No, he's gonna... Thea, this is not negotiable. I'm telling you this out of respect because I don't want to be dishonest with you and say, no, we're not going to tell anybody. I'm going to tell Flex. I promise you it will be okay. But I have to. Are you sure? I promise you. And so I called Flex the night before I planned to resign. I didn't know how to resign. A letter. Do I walk in there? Hey, Ange, what's up? Flex was in his car driving. I'd been checking in with him a lot since his mom passed. I need to talk to you. Uh-oh, what's wrong? I guess he could hear in my tone that this was serious. That's when I broke it to him that I had been having conversations with Clear Channel. Yeah? Well? And I couldn't even get it out. No. His voice starts cracking. Ange, no. I remember him saying it in such a painful voice, my heart hurt. I wanted to start bawling. Flex, I have to. For a second, it got really quiet. Silence on the phone. Hold on, let me pull over, he said. So he pulls the car over and I told him everything that they offered me. Okay, he said. You're doing the right thing. I don't want you to feel like you're not. You are. So who have you told? I haven't told anybody. I'm telling you first. Well, let's just wait. You didn't sign anything yet, right? Flex asked, hoping this was still negotiable. No, Flex, I signed the contract. I'm resigning tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
There was a beat. Well, you need to call Rick. Rick Cummings was the vice president of programming for all the Emmis radio stations. He wasn't based in New York, but he'd been with the company since I had. Flex said it again. You gotta go to Rick. You're absolutely right. I'm gonna call him tomorrow. No, Ange, you have to call him tonight. Don't do that to him. Don't blindside him in the morning. Give him the respect and call him tonight. I had already told Thea I was only going to tell Flex. But Flex walked me through what was the right thing to do and who I should talk to first, second, and third. You call Rick tonight. You show up at the station tomorrow and tell them in person. And then you get on that radio and you say goodbye. Do you think they're going to let me do that? Ange, you're going to say goodbye. You're not going to walk out of that building without saying goodbye. That's not going to happen. So I call Rick. In the whole time I worked for the company, I maybe had called Rick 2 times ever before. Bizarrely, about a month before, in the middle of my negotiations with Thea, Rick asked me to dinner. At first, I thought he'd gotten wind of my news. Instead, he apparently wanted to pick my brain, as he seemed to sense that things weren't great at the station. The irony was that after all these years, this was the first time I had really spent with him. And as much as I was dying to help him put out a few of the fires, I had to remind myself that this was time to let go. Instead, I ordered another round of sake. Finally, Rick and I had a chance to bond, and now I have to make this call. No answer, just voicemail. I hang up, somewhat relieved, and call Flex back to tell him Rick didn't answer. I have another number, Flex says. Call it. Fuck. I call and leave a message. Hey, Rick, it's Angie Martinez. Call me when you get a sec. I really need to talk to you. I hang up. Fuck. I left the message. Now it's real. This was on a weeknight at around 10:30 p.m. And these are corporate guys in Indianapolis. The phone rings and I see the weird area code. Shit, I know this is him. Hey, Angie, it's Rick. What's going on? With my heart pumping and my voice cracking, I blurt out. Well, I got an offer to go somewhere else. Oh, he said. Yes, Clear Channel made me a really great offer to come there and give me multiple markets, and I want to take it. Wow. I'm assuming your contract must be up, right? Yeah. Wow, we really messed up there, huh? I just kind of laughed. Well, look, Ange, you know I can't offer you that. I don't have that to offer you, Rick said. If I could, I would. As much as you've done for this company, I can't think of anything else to say to you, but thank you for everything you've done and to wish you well. It was so sweet. That means so much. Thank you, Rick, I said. I was really worried about having to tell you. Holy shit, every time I told someone, it became more real. Later that night, I'm texting enough. I need to talk to you. Call me as soon as you can. He doesn't reply. Come to find out, the next day I was actually texting the wrong number, because I had like 3 numbers for him. I barely slept at all that night because I was so worried about missing a beat. At 2 a.m., I'm anxiously writing everything down. Everybody I needed to tell, anything that could go wrong, plotting what I would do, drafting what I was going to say on social media. I didn't know what the fuck was going to happen when the sun rose on a very different day for me. If there was ever a holy shit, this is it moment in my life, it was that next morning. I was going to work for the last time and would be letting everyone know. Thea was going to tell her staff at 10 a.m. when the Breakfast Club got off the air. And I was going to tell my general manager at the same time. On my way to the station, I called Enough, and he still didn't pick up. I texted him again, but of course it was the freaking wrong number, so he never got the text, which breaks my heart to this day. I called Miss Info. I trusted Enough and Miss Info and knew they could hold off for a couple of hours and not tell anybody. Miss Info knew how bad it had gotten at the station. We'd spent many, many hours talking about it and trying to figure out how to fix it. And when I told her I was leaving, she didn't react as a co-worker. She reacted as my friend. "Wow, that's great," Miss Info said. "That's what you should be doing. This makes so much sense." She was so positive and excited about it, and she made me feel better. "Well, I'm on my way there now to tell everybody." "Oh my God, good luck," she said. "Let me know if you need me to do anything." At 10 a.m., I walk into my general manager's office, and he's not there. He's not even in town. It didn't even occur to me that this could happen. "Is he coming back today?" I ask his assistant, Pat. "No, he's in D.C., she says. "I really need to talk to him." "Okay, I'll leave him a message." "No, Pat, I need to talk to him, like, now." So I wind up having to tell Dion on the phone, which was fine because I didn't even really have a relationship with him anyway. Next, I call Ebro and tell him. And he says he's on his way back to the station. At this point, since I had said it a few times, it started to feel more comfortable hearing these words come out of my mouth. The brand new intern program director, Jay Dixon, was really gracious about it. He said he was happy for me, but bummed that he was going to miss out on an opportunity to work together. Something he had been looking forward to. Jay and I are in his office talking when Ebro comes in. And Ebro is mad. Like jaws visibly tight, angry. "Ebro, what's up?" Jay says. Sitting in the office that used to be Ebro's. "I mean, I'm already just thinking about seeing you next to that logo." Ebro saying this all in an aggressive way. He's already in war mode. "You're our sister. We wish you well, of course. That goes without saying. But I'm already thinking about how this is going to play out. How they'll spin it. How they'll use it against us." "Ebro, do you know out of every person I've told so far, you're the only one to react this way?" "I get it, Ange. I get it. I'm just being realistic about what we're going to have to face," he said. "So how do you want to do it?" "Well, I would like to do my last show today so I could say goodbye." "Okay," Jay said. He asked if Clear Channel might be willing to wait a week to make the announcement. I said, "Probably not." He looked concerned. "Can you just give us a few minutes so we can figure out how we're going to handle this? Now it's 11 a.m. and I'm supposed to be on the air at 3 p.m. At that moment, I say, "Sure, I'll give you guys a minute." I stand, leave his office, and walk out of the building, and I'm literally shaking. Holy fuck, I just quit. This is crazy. As I'm walking to Sushi Samba to get lunch, I call Thea. "Well, I did it," I said. "How'd it go?" "They're asking if we can wait a few days before the announcement." "I don't know, Ange. Clear Channel wants to go. They want to announce." "Please, Thea. I want to be able to get on the radio and say goodbye. Can you please buy me at least a day?" If Clear Channel announced right away that I was going to be on Power, I knew I couldn't get on the radio at Hot for my final show. She agreed. I hang up the phone and I'm just frozen. I hit Nikki and told her I did it. She leaves her job immediately and hops in a cab to meet me. By the time I get to Sushi Samba, she's already there. "I need a white wine," I said, as soon as I sat down and started telling her everything. "Well, you know I had to call for some backup," Nikki said. I looked up and Tracy and Leonie are walking into the restaurant. I just started bawling. Something about the three of them all being there in the middle of this big moment made me emotional for the first time during this whole situation. No matter what, my three girls were right there with me. While Leonie was proofreading the statement I had written for Instagram, I called Flex and told him what had just happened. "So we're going to go on a three, right?" he asked. "Honestly, Flex, I don't know if they're going to let me. They told me to give them some time to figure it out, and Ebro's angry." "Nah, fuck that. We're going on the radio at three," he said. "I'm on my way." After lunch, I'm walking back to the station, and from across the street, I see Enough and Patty Duke sitting in front of the building, looking like somebody died. Oh my God, everybody knows. I walked up, and Enough gave me a big hug. "I've been trying to reach you since last night," I said, and I showed him my phone. "Ange, that's the wrong number. I got this other number. I'm so sorry. I wanted to tell you." "It's all right. You know I love you." "I understand." And that was everything that happened before the memo went out. And I was confronted by everybody lined up in the hallway in tears. What I couldn't say in that moment was that I knew my leaving would be good for everyone. That the change wasn't just about me leaving, but about creating opportunities for others that couldn't happen the way it had been going. Sometimes you have to shake shit up to get forward motion. By now, you know most of the highlights that flashed in front of my eyes as I walked down the hall to the studio for my last installment of the Angie Martinez Show on Hot 97. Right before we started, I had a conversation with Flex, Ebro, and Jay Dixon about how to approach the show. Jay felt we should still play music and be mindful of the length of our talk breaks. Flex wasn't having it. No, there's no rules for today, he insisted. Even Ebro got on board, understanding that we needed to have the moment. Nah, it's not that type of day, Jay, Ebro said. You just gotta let the rules go. You just gotta let it happen. Angie, today will be my last day on Hot 97. DJ Enough. Right. We're gonna celebrate, Angie. So today, I know, everybody let it sit in for a second. It's sad, but it's also exciting, and I wanna celebrate today. I wanna celebrate you guys. I wanna celebrate what we've built. I wanna celebrate my time here. Flex is on his way in. Terrence J is even here. What are you doing here, Terrence? Terrence, I came to support Angie. She supports me. I love you, sis. Angie, I love you too. DJ Enough, that's what's up. Angie. So yeah, it's, you know, it's time. There have been things that I wanted to do for quite some time. And, you know, I love you guys. Oh God, I'm not going to get emotional. We're on till 7 tonight. I got to hold it together. It's very emotional. Everybody's emotional here. You know, it's a family, so you get stuck sometimes and afraid to... Ebro. To move on. Spread your wings. Angie. Thank you, Ebro. DJ Enough. But you got some great things coming up, Ange. Angie. And it's time. You know, I have opportunities that I want to pursue, and it's time. And we just took it from there. It was an emotional, heartwarming, and phenomenal day. I was proud of how far I'd come and what I had accomplished. And I was filled up by the outpouring of love. Although the magnitude of it hit us all on air by the end of the show, I reassured my listeners that life moves on. You can't stay still. You have to grow. And my listeners reassured me that if you respect them and stay honest with them, they'll ride with you for a long time. I was no longer Angie Martinez from Hot 97. That was how I had introduced myself for years. It was how I thought of myself. Part of me was afraid to let that go, but I was more afraid to only ever be that. As much as Hot 97 had helped to make me who I was ready to stand on my own. A couple of days after announcing that I had resigned, I was having a drink with my friend Tiffany at the bar at Houston's in New Jersey. Two Latina girls in their 30s were sitting next to us. I could tell that they knew who I was because they kept kind of looking over, but they were mostly minding their business. Then finally, one of the young women leaned over and said, "I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just had to say, I want to wish you luck. We were listening when you resigned." "Thank you," I said. "That means a lot to me." It did, especially because of all the flack I had been getting on social media, people calling me a traitor and worse. "No, I wanted to thank you," she explained. "I just left a job that I had for a really long time. So what you did and talked about inspired me to feel like I was doing the right thing because I was so nervous." We had such a real conversation. This is so dope. That was more important to me than any negative spin that anyone could put on my journey. I love that she said inspired, because that feeling was what I wanted to take with me when I started the new job. It was real. My first day at Power was like the first day at a new school. I didn't know what to expect. I was walking into a station and going to work with people who had been considered our enemy at Hot 97 for so many years. Thea told me that everybody was excited, but I wasn't sure how people were going to treat me. My first introduction was as a guest on The Breakfast Club. Friends or foes, I had met most of them before, and they were all radio pros. DJ Envy. Morning, everybody. It's DJ Envy, Angela Yee, Charlamagne Tha God. We are The Breakfast Club. We got a special guest that's not usually on that side of the mic. She's usually on this side of the mic. Angie. I hate being on this side of the mic. It's the weirdest thing ever. Charlamagne, a radio icon. DJ Envy. That's right. Charlamagne, the legendary DJ Envy. Yes. Charlamagne, Miss Angie Martinez, DJ Envy, the voice of New York, Angela Yee, one of the only people that has ever made Charlamagne nervous, because he used to say to me all the time, I wonder if Angie Martinez hates me. You think she hates me? She doesn't like me. Charlamagne, no, 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 no. Angie, why would you think that? I mean, you've said dumb things in the past that bothered me. Charlamagne, nothing about you, though. Angie, have you? Charlamagne, never. Angie, no, maybe not. But I, Charlamagne, never, never, ever. Angie, never hated you. I respect what you do. I told you this. Charlamagne, and that's how I felt when I seen you at 4040. I was like, yeah, I just want to go up there and tell her I respect her, but I was always too pussy to do it. DJ Envy, how does it feel? Everybody wants to know why. You know, you've been with the station for 15 years. Charlamagne, let's get it out of the way. Angela Yee, yeah. DJ Envy, why? Angie, I honestly, it was time for me to go. And this company offers so much opportunity for growth. I wanted to be on in different cities. I want to be able to grow. I want to be able to have new challenges, see new things. I want to learn this studio, how this studio works. And I just, it was time, you know? I felt like I'd done what I can do at that company. And I think my friendships remain. Not bad for a first day. But I have to admit that I was definitely having some anxiety about my first show on the air. For starters, I worried that I'd say Hot 97 instead of Power 105.1 out of habit or whatever. Or that I was going to give out the Hot 97 phone number by accident. Just because it was such a part of my brain by now. In the new place, I had all kinds of worries. But the funny thing is that as soon as I hit that on-air button, it was like, is this me? Is this the right button? What's up, New York? Tri-state area. It's Power 105.1. I said it. It's Angie Martinez. I'm still me. That's all I needed to remember. That I had the experience and expertise to rise to the new challenges. And ultimately, I was as comfortable as ever on the air. Everyone was happy for me, too. A ton of friends and artists called in to wish me good luck on that first day, including Puffy, DJ Khaled, Alicia Keys, and Swiss Beatz. And right before I signed off, Jay called. Oh, you think he was going to do this show without me? He joked. I didn't book any in-studio guests for my first show because I really wanted to talk to the listeners. And I did. That first day on air, I felt like half the city called in. I talked to so many people who truly helped me to put my fears to rest. It was that simple. Just pressing the on-air button that first time and thinking, and we're off. That day and every day since, the show continuously has been number one. We've broken all types of ratings records, not only on air, but digitally as well, with people watching our interviews online all over the world. As much as that makes me happy, ultimately, what motivates me the most is that I still really love this shit. I hear people complain all the time about how hip hop has changed. And while I miss some of the elements of what it used to be, I'm still very much inspired by the notion that we are forever evolving. The music, the technology, and the way in which we exchange ideas and share new content. Even when the content itself is changing. What we're talking about, what we care about, what moves the needle. I'm constantly inspired by people within the culture who push the boundaries. There's always something to learn. In the past year alone, I've had the opportunity to sit across from Ice Cube talking about prejudices based on race and hip-hop culture in Hollywood, right after he broke records telling the groundbreaking story of Icon's N.W.A. and J. Cole sharing his perspective on capitalism, integrity, and the power of hip-hop. And Nicki Minaj bravely and emotionally opening up about love. These are the moments that matter most to me. When I can be part of a conversation that resonates and has the potential to spark something in someone else. These are the moments that keep me engaged and connected. These are the moments that remind me how powerful our voices can be. Epilogue. Find the inspiration. I'm not saying it's all been happily ever after since the big move, but I know that I'm where I'm supposed to be. My family is healthy and thriving, thank God. And I love our squad, as we call it, that Aronde and I have with his son Christian, who I am so lucky to have as a second son. And of course with Nico, my beautiful, funny, good-hearted boy. I love seeing the brotherhood between Nico and Christian. Where Nico's more like me and he can be reserved and thoughtful, Christian is possibly the most fearless kid I've met in my whole life. The two balance each other very well. We take our family seriously and enjoy each other. These boys, and Aronde too, crack me up and make me laugh out loud every single day. Nothing is better than laughter. We have Sunday family meetings over crab legs to talk about the highs and lows of our weeks and let the boys bring up anything on their minds. Being with my family in those moments keeps me balanced and at my happiest. We also have an amazing extended family, an unexpected blessing. In an effort to keep Nico close with his half-brother Jordan, his father Tamir's eldest son, Jordan's mother Margot and I began to get the boys together regularly on our own when Nico was about 3 years old. In the process, Margot and I just clicked. Before long, we started having family celebrations with her and her husband Clayton, and with Jordan, as well as their three other boys. Over the years, we've gotten so close, spending holidays together, cheering for each other's kids at basketball games, and going to Disney World multiple times as one big family. In fact, I'm now the godmother for all four of their children, Jordan included. So on a Saturday night, it's not uncommon for me to have six boys lying around in my living room. Nico, now 12, Christian, 10, Jordan, 15, Caden, 8, Brandon, 6, and Mason, 5. Can you imagine breakfast? And then there's my new family at my new home at Power 105.1, which has been an amazing place for me to challenge myself and learn new ways to do radio. As a company, iHeart is growing in such unique ways. It's been incredible to watch that firsthand. I'm also passionate about my production company, Media Noche, which I launched to tell different stories than I can on the radio. I'm excited to develop content for unique voices that don't currently exist in media. Stories and platforms for voices like mine. I'm intrigued by underserved voices, and I've had the opportunity to try to champion them in other ways, including recently being tapped by President Barack Obama to participate in a criminal justice reform panel at the White House. In fact, the morning of the panel when I arrived in D.C., I was told that Obama would be saying a few words, and I was asked to introduce him. Me? To me, it seemed crazy, but the people on his administration who put the panel together seemed to value my voice and my audience. So I stood up on stage as a representative of hip-hop culture, of Latin culture, and women, and introduced the President of the United States, Barack Obama. To say it was an honor would be an understatement. I still show the video to anyone who will watch. And the screensaver on my phone is a photo of me standing behind Obama like a nervous Olivia Pope. A few months later, I was invited back to serve on another panel, this time representing women in hip-hop. I'm proud to have a role in these panels and to use my voice to represent my culture. The response to my White House debut was overwhelming, as it was the year before when I started at Power. I was feeling so much inspiration and energy from the support of my listeners and the hip-hop community and my city. The beauty of inspiration is that it goes two ways. When people tell me that I've inspired them, it inspires me to want to do more, to push myself and make them proud. It was then that I thought, now, in this moment, I could do something great. I was just looking for the right opportunity. As it happened, I was at my son's baseball game one afternoon when my girlfriend, Amber Sabathia, our kids play ball together, and she's married to CeCe Sabathia, who plays for the Yankees, told me that she was running the New York City Marathon for CeCe's foundation, Pitchin, to raise money for kids in underserved communities. She was putting together a team and offered me a spot to run. It wasn't the challenge I envisioned, but I'd been watching the marathon since I was a kid and was always in awe of it. The thing was that I hated to run and could never imagine doing that. Which is exactly why running the New York City Marathon was on my bucket list. I thought, if I could do that, I could do anything. And in a moment of courage, I told Amber, okay, I'm in. It was only 4 months from the marathon and I hadn't been working out for some time. Did I mention I also never ran? Still, I signed up and made an announcement on the radio. Then there's the press release. A race date is looming and there's no turning back. It's not pretty. I cannot run a mile. Not one fucking mile. I feel like a fraud every time someone congratulates me. If I went outside right now and somebody asked me to run 2 miles, I would drop dead. The New York City Marathon is 26.2 miles long. Amber sent me a training schedule of how to go from nothing to a marathon in 3.5 months. So I go outside the first day to start training. Let's see how this goes. I wanted to cry. Not only because I realized I was in such terrible shape, but also because I realized how ridiculous it was that I'd committed to this. Why would I do this to myself? I got in touch with a trainer I'd worked with years before, Mark Jenkins, who also trained Puffy for the marathon. On our first day out, Mark teaches me how to dog trot. It's like walking with a lift. He explained that when you want to stop, instead of stopping, just bring it down to this dog trot. After having to cancel a few sessions because of my schedule, I knew Mark wasn't going to work out. So from there, I was on my own. I know how to push myself. I need to be in tune with my body. I'm going to go out there by myself, so I need to figure this out by myself. According to the training schedule, I was supposed to be running 4 days a week, sometimes five, but I quickly started falling way behind the rest of the team. So for the most part, I ran alone. Find the inspiration. That became my mantra while training for the marathon. There's inspiration everywhere, by the way. Coming across another runner who's struggling to keep pace and never stops. The sunset over the Hudson River. The music blasting through my headphones. I'd put on a song that gave me a burst of inspiration. Find the inspiration. I listened to music all the time while I was training. Marc Anthony's Aguanile, a Hector Lavoe remake, made me feel like there was a Holy Ghost in the song. That gave me extra energy when I needed it. That was definitely high on my playlist. Along with J. Cole, Young Jeezy, Meek Mill, anything that moved me or made me forget I was running. To switch it up, I tried different routes almost every time I trained. Around my neighborhood, Central Park, the George Washington Bridge, Washington Heights. I would run over the George Washington Bridge and run past my old neighborhood in Washington Heights and feel inspired by how far I'd come. A few times Nico would ride his bike alongside me. I loved those days. And before one long run, when I was feeling really down about my progress, Aronde offered to run with me. He's not a runner, but there he was alongside me in full support. When we got back to the house, he took 2 steps inside and laid down on the living room floor, still in his running clothes. That 16 miles kicked his ass. He literally couldn't move and stayed there on the floor until the next day. At some point, I brought him a pillow for under his head. Marathon training was taking a toll on the whole family. Something definitely started happening in that training. You start seeing the city in a different way and thinking about your life. It's almost like meditation because you're resting your brain. So that part of running, I did learn to appreciate and actually enjoy. The whole purpose of our team running the marathon was to raise money, and now we're starting to get support. I had a donation jar in the studio. Neil came and put $100 in there. Khaled dropped $100, as did most of my guests. Then Puffy called in and donated $1,000 for every mile that I ran. That's $26,000. It was such a nice gesture, especially considering our history. I appreciated it and I was grateful for it. But it also added pressure. Because now there's tens of thousands of dollars involved and I'm clearly not even close to ready. Holy shit. Everybody expects me to do this marathon. The pressure built as the day drew closer. Every day I'd be limping into work because I was so hurt from my run the night before. I always had sneakers on. I couldn't even bear to do my hair anymore. It was all about training. In the middle of my training, there was a half marathon at Central Park, so I signed up. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't want anybody to know I was there. I just wanted to see if I could do a half, knowing that in a month I had to go do a whole. I took an Uber to Central Park and sat there by myself, looking at all these people stretching. I felt like if I could do this, and if it was kind of easy, then I would have a lot more confidence. Just the opposite happened. I was the second to last person to finish the whole thing. That includes the senior citizens and the handicapped people. I'm not even kidding. I finally get to the damn finish line and they're already closing it down. Cleaning up and putting the boxes and bagels away. I'm pathetic, asking, can I get a bagel, please? I grabbed my bagel and I was looking at the bench not too far away. Can I make it to the bench to sit down? I could hardly walk. Oh my God, that half marathon almost put me in the grave. How am I supposed to do a whole one in a month? 3 weeks before the marathon, Amber and the team decided to do an 18-mile run together, beyond anything I'd ever tried. I did it, and I didn't die, but I hurt my right hip flexor. In a lot of pain, I hoped it would just be a couple of days. It wasn't. A week later, I still couldn't walk. So I started going to physical therapy every day straight for 2 weeks. But for those 3 weeks before the marathon, I didn't run at all. I was in recovery, taking ice baths, trying to just walk normal, let alone run. I was absolutely in freak out mode at this point, panicking. The doctor gave me the okay to show up at the marathon, although he warned me that it was going to hurt. Crack of dawn on Sunday, November 2nd, 2014. I showed up the same way I always fucking show up through my whole career. Even though I'm not prepared. Yes, I'll show up. I'll run the marathon. I could barely run the half as it was healthy. Now I gotta go do this whole and I'm hurt. I came up with this mantra that running the marathon was similar to having a baby. Giving birth hurts like hell. But no matter how bad the pain was, the baby still has to come out. There's no option. And I applied that thought to my race. I know this is going to be really painful, but ultimately, like delivering a baby, I have to finish. I took the option of quitting out altogether. They put our team with the elite runners and the celebrity group. It's the actress, Terry Hatcher, who's an avid runner, Olympic gold medalist, Billy DeMong, tennis star, Carolyn Wozniacki. With one look around, I could tell I have no business in this tent. They have all kinds of gadgets, roll-on things, and tape things. Billy, the Olympic gold medalist, is telling me how he was training in the Himalayas and explaining how he'd stay hydrated. He didn't have an ounce of fat on his body, and he was going to run this thing in an hour. I was still hobbling. Fuck. It's freezing that day. The winds are abnormally strong. We get to the starting point. Lined up by the Verrazano Bridge in Staten Island. As soon as we start, the whole group quickly sprints ahead of me. There goes Terry Hatcher. There goes the fucking Olympians. There go the Kenyans. Everybody's passing me. My girls Amber and Alexis were in pretty good shape, so they were moving ahead too. We're not even a half mile in and Amber, God bless her, turns around. Come on, Ange, we gotta get our pace. Amber, go. No, it's too soon. I don't want to leave you. We just started. Amber, just go. I didn't want to have the pressure of trying to keep up. I need to go super slow or I'm not going to finish this. Are you sure? Go. So they all leave me. There's hundreds of us. Then there's 10 of us. Then there's like 5 of us. Then there's me. By myself on the Verrazano Bridge. I am literally the last person on the Verrazano Bridge. Not only am I the last, but I'm the only person on the Verrazano Bridge by myself. I could jump off this bridge. That could be a way I could get out of this. It was so cold out there. So quiet. But fuck it. I run. I'm slow, but I get over the bridge and I run off the bridge into Brooklyn. The streets are empty. It's still just me. Eventually, other runners from behind me start catching up and I start feeling less like a loser and an outcast. Now I'm just part of the group. Even though I was sore, I was so present the whole time, paying attention to the people in the cheering crowd, amazed at how many people were standing in the cold to support us. Come on, you got this. You're just getting started. You're going to do this. Congratulations. The whole way through the marathon, they're encouraging you. It was so touching and overwhelming that I did not put my music on. Not one time. I was like fucking Rain Man out there. I'm just going to finish. Just going to finish. Just going to finish. Every time my brain went into, this is impossible, I would find something else to distract me or inspire me. Stopping was not an option. Everybody says, run your own race. You really do have to run your own race. In everything. In anything. It's a good lesson in life. Not just in marathon running. At mile 7, I had the notion, holy shit, you're going to run the marathon. Yes. You're going to do it. And then there was the Queensboro Bridge. Mile 15. Everybody talks about that moment. And it's real. It's when you hit the wall. I'm already pacing slower than I had hoped. I was really trying to be in the 6-hour range. And that would be my goal on the perfect day. My right knee started to hurt really bad as soon as I got on the bridge. Even stepping on it was painful. And it was beginning to swell. I was looking for something that I could tie around my knee to put some sort of compression on the swelling. As people get hot, they start throwing their scarves, hats, gloves off. There were clothes everywhere on the bridge. I found a piece of material. It could have been from a headband or a piece of ripped t-shirt or something. And tied it around my knee. Trying to make some sort of MacGyver bandage. This was what I was afraid of. This is the pain. I want to stop right now. It was so windy that the flaps on my hood were clapping against my head. And I began praying. Please, God, just get me through this. I'm gonna need help here. Please just carry me the rest of the way. Carry me the rest of the way. And then, when I most needed it, I would find the inspiration. I'd see a few other struggling women out there running, determined to make it. And I'd run alongside them for a few minutes and we'd give each other energy. I know it sounds a little kooky, but there really is something powerful about looking around you and finding the inspiration. It does push you. And that's how I got through the marathon, literally. The people in the city, the crowds cheering and holding signs, and the marathon volunteers on the side giving out Gatorade. I really took energy from the people in the streets to get me through. I make it through Queens and the Upper East Side, and then in the Bronx, it was quieter. I was dragging my right leg at this point, like skipping, trying to get the pressure off that leg. After that, it got a little blurry for me. It was an out-of-body type of push toward the end. The next thing I remember was seeing my girlfriend Liani out there waiting for me on the sidelines as the route went back into Manhattan. Liani, I gasped. I was so happy to see her. She ran alongside me for a little bit, all the way up to the entrance of Central Park. Liani veered off and I was on my own again, and in a lot of pain. As close as I was, I could stop. I know it's only a mile or so left, but it's still a fucking one more mile. And I'm going to die right now. I'm not gonna make it. As much as I wanted to keep going, I couldn't stop from visualizing my body caving in and falling to my knees and then laying on the ground. I could feel my knees buckling and I could see it. Knee, knee, elbow, elbow, on my stomach, on the ground, on the fucking side of Central Park. My body was pulling me down as in, lie down, bitch. Like it was literally giving out and pulling me down. The crowd is thinning out because now it's late. It's freezing and it's getting dark. I remember that moment vividly because there was a lady on the sidelines. She was so sweet and so direct. She spoke right to me. Don't do it, baby. I know it hurts, but you're almost there. I'm so proud of you. You almost got this. That lady made me cry. It was like she could read me. She saw that I was close to the end and was ready to give up. And she gave me a little breath, a little energy. From there, I pushed toward the finish line, lifted up by that lady and the grace of God and everyone else along the way. People like that are amazing to me. Who was that woman? What was she doing there? Did she live in the neighborhood? Did she know that she was going to make a difference for somebody? As I was coming toward the end, I heard some friends from work call out my name and I waved to them. Then I saw Nico a few feet from the finish line. I had to stop and give him a hug. My mom was with him calling out, I'm so proud of you. And Nikki was there with flowers. I saw the finish line. It was right there. As I approached with whatever energy I had left, I raised my arms in the air in celebration and hobbled through the finish line. I was overwhelmed, exhausted, proud. I had done it. Of course, the rest of the team had finished more than an hour and a half before me, but they waited. We did it. And we raised more than $100,000. The point is, you never know what you can do until you really put yourself out there and try. Do it. Whatever it is. Challenge yourself. If you can't imagine the finish line, the first step is to just show up. And don't worry about what everyone else is doing. Run your own race. I'm not saying it will always be easy. Things haven't always been easy for me. But I worked hard. And I put myself out there. I've accomplished things that I've never dreamed were possible. I've seen a lot and learned a lot, and I'm proud that I've been true to myself the whole way. In that, I found the power of my voice.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of My Voice, written and read by Angie Martinez. Additional dialogue read by Michael K. Williams, DJ Drama, and Marnell Mazel, a.k.a. M.E.Z. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and Angie Martinez. Text copyright 2016 by Medianoche Productions, Inc. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.